Blog Talk Radio
presents a Blog Radio Show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a Blog Radio Show. I'm Joanne Barton, and I hope you're all doing well. We've got another great show for you guys tonight. I'm so excited to welcome back to the show Billy Vera from Billy Vera and the Beaters, but much more than that. Billy is a singer, songwriter, author, oh my God, actor, I mean, musician, just everything. And Billy, he probably doesn't remember that he was on the show a very long time ago, but we're going to talk to him about that. So let's just get started because I missed the call with Billy, so I want to get him on the air. So without further ado, welcome to a Blog Radio Show, Mr. Billy Vera. How are you, sir? Thank you so much for hanging out with me tonight.
Well, I'm great, Joanne. Thanks for having me.
Do you remember coming on my show? It was a long time ago.
I do about one or two of these a week.
Exactly.
So it's a little
You'll
hard.
Never remember. Right. You can't remember where you are. But no, I actually just started the show. It had to be about 4 years ago. I don't remember exactly when you were on. And I was so honored that you joined me. And, you know, it was a brand new show. And you were so kind. Thank you so very much. And I apologize. I wasn't able to call you before we started. We had so many songs to upload into the computer here that it took me forever. I'm like, God, your career is just amazing, Billy. And
sounds like
you
went to my Wikipedia.
Well, I know about you, obviously. I mean, but of course I had to get some information from
Wikipedia.
You
had to do your homework, huh?
Absolutely. You kidding me? Oh, my goodness. Well,
there's nothing worse than coming onto one of these shows and the person didn't do their homework.
Oh, I know.
But you know
right?
what you do? You learn after a while. You learn to interview when you smell one of those people coming. You learn to interview yourself.
Yeah, you got to do. You got to play the game, right?
Oh,
I know.
Baby, I've done that too many times.
Exactly. Well, before we start, I did want to say how sorry I am for the loss of. Oh my goodness, what the heck was that? I wanted to say, send you my condolences for the loss of Larry. I know you were very good friends with Larry Chance, and I recently got to know him over the last 3 years, and what a beautiful man. So I am terribly sorry for the loss.
We were friends for 60 years.
Wow.
1963.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of 63, you've been going since the 60s. My God. Now, you've worked with just about everybody. So I do want to ask you this. Now, why did you change your name to Billy Vera?
Well, I changed it to Billy Vera. To my dad, Bill McCord,
right,
was a radio and television announcer on NBC for some 35 years.
Yeah.
And I had the same manager that Larry and the Earls had when I was about 16 years old. His name was Jim Gribble, and he said, you know, if you go out there as Billy McCord, he said, everybody's going to confuse you with your father.
Right.
Because, you know, my dad would do some of the quiz shows, you know, like Tic-Tac-Toe and Concentration, and
yeah,
the guy would say, well, Bill McCord, who's our next guest? Well, Jack, our next guest is a housewife from New Jersey. and so my dad's name was out there. So I knew a girl whose last name was Vera. You know, rhymes with Yogi Berra.
Yeah,
or Geraldo Rivera.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to steal her name because it's only got four letters.
Yeah.
And it'll fit in bigger letters on the marquee if I ever get on a marquee. And
oh,
so I stole her name.
Now, Mom, she was a background. Was she a backup singer for Ray Charles, or was she a Raylette?
No. She was in the Ray Charles Singers. Before there was the Ray Charles that we all know and love.
Yeah.
And certainly that Ray is one of my heroes.
Yeah.
There was a Ray Charles who had a choral group that sang background on all of Perry Como's hits and on Perry Como's television show every Saturday night. And my
boy,
mom
was
a part
wrong.
Of that group.
Yeah, boy, was I wrong. So music was in the house. Entertainment industry was in the house. So when you were younger, I mean, what age were you when you realized that you had some kind of musical ability of your own?
Well, I'm still working on that part. But
yeah, right.
No, I, you know what it was? I was around show business since I was, you know, a little five-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, and before we moved to New York, we lived in Cincinnati, and where my dad was an announcer there, and my mom was a solo singer of some repute. And, you know, I'd go along with her to the radio shows and the TV shows. And, you know, TV was a new thing back then. And, you know, I'd sit on somebody's lap while she was on camera. And so I was around it, you know, all the time. And then later, you know, one of these other shows, I'd be a little tiny boy in the dressing room with all these half-naked singers and dancers and just saying, boy, this feels good. I like being around all these pretty women. You know?
Right, right. But what was your first instrument when you, because you, I mean, you've been writing for years, so you've been playing too.
My first instrument was drums.
Okay.
But I didn't play professionally or even with a band. I just played in my room, you know, along with my favorite records. And then.
That's the best way to learn. That's the best way to learn.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Mm-hmm.
But I also took lessons, so I was schooled. Musician, and then I got a guitar, and my mom gave me guitar lessons, and then also piano, and I found it was easier to write songs on piano because you had more notes you could play.
Mm. Yeah, don't you think that every household with children in it should have an instrument in it, and this music, you never know what talent they have until they have it in front of them. You know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and when you see, you know, my mother would bring home records because my mother had a pretty hip taste. She'd bring home Sinatra records, Nancy Wilson, and Nat King Cole, and Duke Ellington. So, apart from the music of my generation, which was, you know, Fats Domino and Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Frankie Lyman was a big hero. Aside from the music of my generation, I also heard the music of her generation, which was a little more sophisticated than the rock and roll. So I had a very wide and broad group of music.
To
hear.
And we're speaking of your mom is Anne Ryan, by the way. And now I got to ask this. Did she ever sing with you on any of your recordings or any songs that you wrote?
No, our careers were apart, you know.
Yeah, but now, speaking of Fats Domino, I mean, you've written songs for him. I mean, you've written songs for Fats Domino, Barbara Lewis. I mean, we know Ricky Nelson because we're going to play that tonight. You were with the band The Remains, The Shirelles. What song did you write for The Shirelles? I'm curious.
I wrote one in their later career in the early 70s called Hung on Yourself. Was on one of the albums. So, yeah. And I was their guitar player and their conductor for a couple of years. Yeah, you know, the 70s were a really slow time for me. You know, I'd had some hits in the 60s, in the late 60s. You know, the music and the culture of America changed drastically.
Yep.
And I couldn't figure out how to fit in. You know, so I just took I took whatever gigs I could get.
Right.
One of which was playing for the different groups.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you're old enough, but in the early 70s in New York, there was an oldies revival. And so there was a lot of work for the 50s acts that came out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to play with so many of them, you know.
Right. Well, right now it's a big deal what's going on with all these the 60s shows and 70s shows. What do you got? The Flower Power Cruise. What's the one I just saw? It was fabulous. Oh my God, I can't believe I can't remember the name of it. Oh my God. Oh my God, I just went and I can't remember the name of it. Oh my God, what song does Eddie and Flo sing?
Oh, Happy Together.
Happy Together Tour. Thank you. The Happy Together Tour. Yeah, that was fantastic.
Yeah, they did a show right around about a block from my house here in L.A.
Did you go?
Well, yeah, because little Anthony invited me. Oh. And, you know, he and his two sons came over to my house and hung out all day. And then we walked over to the theater, and Anthony killed it, man. He was great.
Oh my God, I had chills. I couldn't believe how good he sounded. He was dancing and everything too. I love him. I love him. It was one of the better shows. I shouldn't say better. One of the best 60s shows I've seen in a while. I mean, the finale. I just loved everything about it was great.
Yeah.
I mean, little Anthony was phenomenal. They all were. But, yeah, I'm hoping to have Ron Dante on in October so we can talk about the tour. So that should be pretty good. But,
he's got
a
heck of a legacy, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, so do you. Let's talk about you. Okay. So so let me – now, you're also, again, besides being a songwriter, you wrote the book From Harlem to Hollywood. You spent a lot of time at the Apollo, I'm thinking, because you did some work with Judy Clay, which was pretty controversial at the time.
I don't know how controversial it was, but it was, we were the first.
Right.
You know, the strange thing was, you know, we had a hit record, we had a couple of hit records, but, you know, nobody had seen us because there were no photographs of us.
I was going to ask you that. Did anybody know what you look like? Because you've got
no.
a soulful voice, so they had
no
idea. No,
nobody knew what I looked like. And
right.
So we got an offer to perform at the Apollo, which to me was, you know, that's the pinnacle of black show business.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had been there many times as a customer. I was there when James Brown recorded that live album. You know, I mean, it was just every major black artist that ever
played there.
Apollo. And,
mm-hmm.
and it was a tough, tough audience. If they liked you, they let you know. And if they did not like you, they let you know.
They let you know, right.
So anyway, we come up there. And in those days, it was a seven-day week and five shows a day.
Mm.
So the night before, you go up there and you rehearse with the house band. So I show up. And Honey Coles, the great tap dancer, was the theater manager. And he looked at me and he said, oh, he said, Harlem hasn't seen you yet. Now, bear in mind, this is 1 month after Martin Luther King got killed.
Oh, wow.
There was riots going on across the river in Newark.
Yep.
Yeah, so I guess they put us on second, which is a lousy spot. You know, the opening act is usually one with a lot of choreography and very flashy. And
who was the opening act? Do you remember?
Yeah, the Radiance. The Radiance.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they were a very good act, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Hunt was the star.
Mm-hmm.
So we go on, and it was, you know, the first show was like 11 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And Honey Cole says, listen, I got an idea. He said, Judy, you enter from stage right.
Mm.
And Billy, you enter from stage left.
Mm.
And you let her take three steps out from the wings before you make your entrance. So I did what I was told. One, two, three, enter.
Right.
I hear 1,500 people gasp at the sight of me. And I could hear them out there going, that's him? That's him? You know? And they loved us.
Right, because they heard your voices in the wings, and then when you came out, they're like, oh, my God, it's a white guy, you know? And
yeah.
You sounded, you know, oh, my God.
Well, they had
crazy.
Heard the record all over the radio, you know?
Right.
And so after the first show, Honey comes upstairs to our dressing room, and he says, I'm going to change up the show. He said, I'm gonna put you all on Right Before the Star, he said, because ain't nobody going to follow you two.
Mm.
And so from that point on, that was our spot, you know, before the headliner.
Right.
And which was a, you know, good spot to be. And we went over extremely well. We got standing ovations and encores and all that stuff. So
yeah, well, it's a great song. So I'd love to share it right now with, for those who don't know it. It was the first interracial love song in 1967, and it's called Storybook Children. I'd love to play it right now, Billy, if that's okay.
Whipping on them.
Absolutely and excellent. I'm saying the two words in one word. This is Storybook Children, Billy Vera and Judy Clay. It made history, and it's still history to this day because it's just a great, great song. It's music history. Enjoy.
You've got your world, and I've got mine, and it's a shame two grown-up worlds that will never be the same. You've got his heart, you've got his savior. If only we were storybook children.
Wow, what a poignant song for the time and even today, you know? Even it stands the test of time, the meaning of it. It really does, especially for what
was
going on.
You know, that's a funny thing you say that because I wrote that with a fellow named Chip Taylor who
mm-hmm.
wrote Wild Thing and Angel of the Morning,
uh-huh.
a great songwriter who happened to have gone to my high school, Archbishop Stepanak up in White Plains.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
cool.
His brother is an actor you might have heard of named John Boyd.
Yes.
And he went to Stepanak also.
Hmm.
Anyway, Chip was sort of a mentor to me as a songwriter. One of the things he told me, he said, forget about trying to write trendy songs, you know, songs for today.
Yeah.
He said, try to write a song you can picture people singing 20 years from now.
Mm.
He said, that's how you make your real money, with a song that lasts.
Right, right.
And he was right.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. And, I forgot what I was going to say. I'm sorry, Billy. I don't write questions down. I'm just having a conversation with you. And then you guys had a follow up with Country Girl City Man too, which was which is another good one too.
Yeah.
So Storybook Children. Again.
Well, here's what happened after that. I'll help you out here since you have
that Storybook Children is still evident and prominent for today, what's going on just in general, you know? So
that's leading
up to.
Well, what happened after that was, Atlantic Records, which was the company we recorded for, they had been connected with Stax Records. And Judy was contracted to Stax, and I was contracted to Atlantic. So when they split up, we could no longer record together.
Oh, no, right.
For that reason. So Jerry Wexler, who was the boss at Atlantic, he called me backstage at the Apollo, and he said, look, and he told me what was happening. He said, but don't worry. He said, I found a song for you that's a killer. He said, I'm going to send it up to the theater, and you take a listen to it, and if you like it, I'll have a big orchestra in there the next day after you finish the Apollo, because I want to get this out right away. So we finish the Apollo. I go down to Atlantic Records 9 a.m. the next morning, and he had a full orchestra there.
Mm.
And we recorded the song, just me, and it was called With Pen in Hand.
Yes, that was a hit,
too. It was written by Bobby Goldsboro.
Mm.
Wonderful song, and it became my first solo hit. So that was a pretty cool thing.
Yes, absolutely. I know that was one of your top tens for sure, out of your top 10 hits, you know. And but the first song that you wrote that took off was, well, the first, not took off, but your first song that you wrote for someone else, I believe, was for Ricky Nelson, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was just starting to write, and there was this new girl singer I heard on the radio named Dionne Warwick, and I liked the way she sang, and so I wrote the song with her in mind, and so I started taking my songs around to music publishers, to try to peddle them, you know, and this guy took a couple of my songs and he paid for demos. And so, you know, I'm waiting. I think, when you're that young, you think everything's going to happen overnight.
Mm.
So maybe a week or two later, he wakes me up one morning. He says, well, I got a record on one of your songs. I said, yeah, which one? He said, Mean Old World. I said, did you get that girl, Dionne Warwick? He said, no, we didn't get her. She's all tied up with Burt Bacharach.
Yeah.
But we got you Ricky Nelson.
Mm.
So I said, Ricky Nelson, he's white. You know, how could he sing my song? You know? Well, as it turned out, Ricky made a great record of it.
Yeah.
And it became a bit of a hit. You know, so that was, that really made me happy. You know, I couldn't believe what an easy business this was, I thought.
Right, right. Well, yeah, at the time.
First song I ever took to a publisher became a hit record, you know.
Were you a Brill Building guy?
No, the Brill Building was down the street. We were at the Cooler Building. It was 1650 Broadway. Brill Building was 1619 Broadway.
Yeah.
And it had a cool name, but 1650 had all the great writers in it. You know,
yeah,
Goffin and King, Man and Wild, Sedaka and Greenfield.
Know.
Everybody was at 1650.
I can't believe they didn't turn those into, like, not museums, but like an attraction. Yeah, museum/attraction.
Historical landmarks or something.
Yeah, but I just still can't believe to this day that they're not. an attraction for people to go in and you know, maybe hear an act once in a while and an acoustic do something, you know. The history behind both of those places is just phenomenal. I've always been fascinated with the Brill Building. I worked in New York.
Well, it's got that beautiful structure on the outside.
Oh, it was gorgeous, yeah.
The
I would walk by it.
It was very plain looking.
Right. And Brill stood out, right, because I would walk by it. I go past Colony Records. Then I go and I just stand at the Brill Building and I look in the glass. I'm like, God, one of these days I just want to walk in there and just feel it, you know, and I never did. And I think it's closed. I mean, I haven't been in the city in quite some time, especially that area. But last time I was there, I didn't see that there was anything happening there. I don't know if it was closed up, but Colony's gone for sure. That I know.
I know.
That
you know, when Storybook Children was hot, they gave us the entire window.
Really?
For a whole week, yeah.
Wow.
Just our album and all that. And, you know, it was crazy because I would get off the train and go up to 1650 to write songs.
Yeah.
And I'd pass by all of the hookers, you know, the prostitutes.
Yeah.
And they would recognize me from the Colony window. And they'd say, oh, there's that Mr. Storybook Children. Hey, baby. So I was a big hit with the prostitutes, you know.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, you weren't bad on the eyes either, so, you know.
I was kind of cute in those days.
Yes, you were adorable. You were very handsome. Well, you still are. What was I going to say? But how old were you at the time when you did Storybook Children and when you sold Mean Old World, roughly?
Well, Mean Old World, I think I was 21.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I shortly after, you know, in those days, you know, music was a cottage industry, so it wasn't the big corporate deal that it is today.
Right.
So if you had a hit record and you were a young fellow, you know, everybody on Broadway knew who you were.
Yeah, you were doing
and
all right.
And so you could easily get in to meet people and play your songs for them and all of that. So it was pretty easy. And then I got a job at this publishing company where I met Chip, April Blackwood Music. It was on the second floor of 1650, and it was owned by CBS and Columbia Records. So they had plenty of money.
And
they gave me a little tiny room with a little half a piano and a telephone, and I'd go in there and write either by myself or with Chip. And it was a great experience because, like, your boss would knock on the door and say, listen, the Shirelles are recording next week or Tony Bennett's recording. See if you can write something for them, you know.
Right.
So you would write to – you would listen to their music and then you'd study them and see what their range was vocally or what kind of subject matter that they liked to sing about. And then you'd try to concoct a song for them. Then you'd make a demonstration record. And then your publisher would run around trying to get your song recorded for you.
Right. What a time. Oh, I wish I was alive then. I mean, I was alive, but I wish I was an adult.
I was probably a little girl back then.
Oh, I was only like 5 or 6, but I mean, the music just lives with me still to this day. You know, all of it. I just love it. Even though I was a kid, you know, I grew up with it too, so I love it. And without it, I don't think I would have ever became a musician myself. I mean, you have to have that foundation of that music to be, in my opinion, to feel music. That's how I feel anyway about it. But I lost my train of thought again. You said something, and then I was going to go on that, and now I had to bring up. What were you saying before I said what an amazing time? I'm so sorry.
Well, we're talking about the Broadway scene.
You were saying how you were writing songs for others. Because I was going to say to you, who broke your heart? Because, man, you're between your vocals and your lyrics. I mean, but then again, you were writing for others. So, but did you really have a reason to write these songs? I mean, or were they?
Well, it was great training. You know, you would write, like I said, you would listen to, you know, what that artist sang about, and also some singers like Patti LaBelle, for example, she has an extremely wide range, so you could write very rangy melodies for her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas somebody like, you know, I don't want to name a name, but, you know, some people had a range of six notes, so you had to keep it really simple for that person. And so you learned how to craft a song for a particular artist. And sometimes we would write a song because one of us had an idea or I had an idea. And well, here's an example. One day, my boss came in and he said, listen, Chuck Jackson is recording next week. See if you can come up with something for Chuck. Now, I was a big fan of Chuck Jackson. You know, Any Day Now, I Don't Want to Cry was great records.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm thinking about Chuck, you know, in my little office there. And I said, well, his records have gotten kind of tired lately. He needs something to kick him in the butt. Let me see. He's got that gravelly voice. Maybe I'll write something about where he can preach, like one of those Baptist preachers.
Yeah.
So I came up with this song called Don't Look Back. And then in the middle, I had an idea, because I had been listening to a song by the blues singer Junior Parker where the music stops right in the middle and he preaches. So I used that as a device for the middle of my song that I was writing for Chuck.
Right.
And so we went in, we made the demo, and Chuck ended up not recording the song. But my publisher took it to Epic Records, and they had a new group from New England called The Remains.
Mm-hmm.
And a rock group, a white rock group. So they recorded it, and they really did a great record of it. And then they went on tour with the Beatles, and you can imagine that the PTSD that they must have had, you know, going on before the Beatles, and all the kids are going, get off the stage, you suck, we want the Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
So they came off the road, and they were just broken, these poor kids.
Wow.
But they made this great record that almost was a hit.
Well, Don't Look Back, I know Robert Plant's version of Don't Look Back. And
that was many years later.
Yeah, and that's great. And was that intended for Cyndi Lauper and Joan Jett, too, and Robert took it, or what?
I was just about to tell you that, yeah.
Sorry.
the record went nowhere, but a few years later, whenever my career goes down the toilet, my record collecting gets more important in my life. So I was down at Village Oldies, and this fellow comes up to me, skinny guy. It's about 1973.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I found I used a song of yours on a compilation album I produced. I said, oh, yeah, which one? He said, Don't Look Back. I said, by The Remains? He said, yeah. He said, don't worry, don't get excited. It didn't sell much, but he said, everybody down here in my part of town loves that song and loves that record. He said, so that made me feel good, but didn't make me any money, but it made me feel good. Cut to about 20 years later, and then I got a number one record of my own, and I get a phone call from Cyndi Lauper's husband.
Hmm.
I don't know how he got my number, but he did, and he said, Cyndi just cut a track on a song of yours called Don't Look Back. And she wants to do it as a duet with Joan Jett. I said, wow, that'll be great.
Yeah.
But it never came out.
Right.
So now I think the Malocchio is on my song, you know, the Jinx.
Mm. Yeah.
And then Robert Plant, I get a demo, a promo record rather, promo CD of Don't Look Back by Robert Plant that was going to be on his new album. And it never made it to the new album. So now I'm really thinking the song is jinxed.
Yeah, exactly.
So now cut to another 20 years, and the song is now 40 years old, and Rhino released Lenny Kaye. That was the skinny guy I told you about.
Yep.
Lenny Kaye, who's Patti Smith's guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
The Nuggets album that he had made back in 73, it came out in an expanded version as a box set and sold a ton of records for Rhino. Mm. So 40 years after writing the song, I finally made some money off it. And then Rhino put out a Robert Plant box set, and it sold a lot of records.
And finally made it to there, yeah.
Yeah, so now cut to this last year. I think it was this past April or May. They did a Nuggets 50th anniversary tour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they did it at a theater here in L.A. And, you know, the remains don't exist anymore. So Lenny Kaye called me up. He said, would you do me a favor and sing your song on the show? I said, sure, I'd love to.
Yeah, yeah.
So I go on there, and there's all these acts, man. Most of them are from generations younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
Like they had, they put a band together to back me up. And in the band that was backing me up, man, was the guitar player from REM.
Get out.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then backstage, I'm meeting all these people, you know, like Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles.
Oh, wow.
And Wayne Kramer from the MC5.
Mm.
And I didn't, you know, they were like later than me, so I figured they don't know who I am. But it was just the opposite. I mean, everybody's coming up backstage and talking to me, and, you know, they knew all my little records that didn't even sell. I mean, they knew more about me than I know, you know.
Oh,
and it was just a thrilling performance.
Right.
And the next day, it was there was reviews in Variety and Hollywood Reporter and all these, and they all saying, man, this the hit of the show was Billy Vera doing Don't Look Back, you know.
Wow.
Said, man, it was the most fun. I mean, I really felt like I was a rock and roll singer again, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like in the old days.
Yeah, you were at a great show, too. My God.
Oh, man, the theater was sold out.
Right.
Every rock critic in town was there.
Wow.
You know, every music nerd in town was there.
Wow.
And then before the show started, they had a meet and greet, you know, everybody signing autographs and stuff. And it was literally the longest line I've ever seen. And I mean, it lasted so long, the show was almost late going on.
Oh, my God.
It was the most awesome thing I've done in years and years and years.
Mm. Have you ever done any of those autograph signing shows that they do? Like this Chiller Theater, they do them out in California. I forget what it's called there. Oh, they'd love you there.
Comic-Con.
Are you kidding me? Comic-Con.
I've done a couple of those, yeah. You know, they mostly put me on there because of a movie I was in called Buckaroo Banzai.
Mm.
It's like a cult movie, you know.
Yeah, they like the B movies. Yeah,
they dragged me out for that one, you know.
Yeah, that's how I found them too. I had a couple of songs in a B movie years ago.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God! And that's how I found out about Chiller, and it's turned now into more of an autograph thing than it originally started. It was started with horror and everything, and
yeah,
now it's
right.
It's all, you know, make money signing pictures. So whatever. But, you had also the same, well, not as many years distanced for a song to become a hit, but At This Moment was written earlier and really didn't take off till Family Ties. So, you know, who knows what's going to come from the past still to this day.
Well, that goes back to Chip's advice, you know, write songs that you think will last a long time rather than just today's songs.
Right. Well, speaking of yesterday, why don't we play the one that got you started, Mean Old World by Rick Nelson, guys.
Oh,
this was,
let's hear that.
This was Billy's first song he wrote. Check it out.
And
mean
the great
Old World.
James Burton playing guitar.
Nice. And this is Rick Nelson, pardon me. He's an adult now, but he's no longer with us, but he's not Ricky, he's Rick. All right, so Mean Old World, Rick Nelson, written by Billy Vera. Enjoy.
I walk in a crowd, hiding tears I can't cry out loud. I can't let them see me cry, 'cause they don't care if I live or die. And it's a mean old world, let me tell you, it's a mean old world. When you need someone, sit in my room, it's a room filled with gloom. I sit and wait by the telephone, but no one cares if I'm all alone. And it's a mean old world, let me tell you, it's a mean old world. When you need someone, me. Sometimes they can be so cruel. All I hope is someday I find one to love my whole life through. I walk down the street, hide my face from the people I meet. They don't see the tears in my eyes. They don't care or even realize that it's a me, oh world. Let me tell you, it's a me, oh world. When you need someone, it's a mean old world. When you need someone, it's a mean old world. Babe, I need someone, it's a mean old world.
Wow, classic 60s. Wow, great. I know what I love about 60s songs? You're in and out. Tells a story, and it's a quick song. It's in and out. You know,
no wasted music.
Yep, no wasted music, no wasted lyrics. It's just to the point, gets it done, and it's great. I could picture Dion doing that song for sure. That's definitely the music was definitely a feel of her.
Yeah,
for
that
sure.
Was the intent, but, you know, the great part is she had Bacharach and David writing for her, and
right,
she didn't need any of us outsiders.
Did she know that that song was intended for her, or does she know?
She was a adopted cousin of Judy Clay, so I knew Dion.
Are you kidding me?
And I knew Dion's sister, Dee Dee, another great singer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, of course, the aunt was Sissy Houston.
Yep.
In fact, one day...
An inspiration. Yep, one of the inspirations.
One day, we were the sweet inspirations, yeah.
Yep.
One day when we were doing the Apollo, Sissy came in there with her little four-year-old daughter.
Uh-oh.
And
who that was.
And that little Whitney, yeah.
Yep.
She was sitting on my lap in the dressing room at 4 years old.
Oh, that's
old.
Too funny. Oh, my
And we
God.
Came off stage that night, we went over really good that night, and Sissy's in the wings with little Whitney in her arms, and I look at Sissy, and there was like tears coming down her cheeks. She was so proud of us.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Well, you know, that's another one. She was around music her whole life, too, and, you know, singing.
Oh, yeah.
And you're singing. I mean, look at, you know, you got... Oh, God. Anyway, you've got so many great songs. My God, I don't know how much time you've got tonight, but I want to keep you
hey,
up.
Hey, baby, I'm here for the duration, you know, as long as you
All
need
right.
me.
All right, I'm here with you. I'm here with you.
I had a big lunch, so I don't have to worry about eating dinner tonight.
Oh, you're too funny. So now, like you said, the 60s were great, 70s were, I don't want to say a lull, but you weren't, like you said, the music changed, so you were more into doing conducting and you know, doing the music conducting for other acts. And so then in the 70s, how'd you get Dolly Parton involved?
Well, that's a good story, too.
Yeah.
By the late 70s, my career was so bad that, I was playing... a Ramada Inn in New Jersey one night, if you can imagine.
Hey, it's New Jersey. Give me a break. That's where I am. I'm only kidding. I know,
yeah.
I know. But no, listen, you were playing. You were playing. I guess.
I was playing,
but, you
and it was a two-week gig. Mm. And, you know, there was some people there on the weekend, but during the week you're playing to three businessmen, you know.
Right, right.
You're staying at the hotel. So this one night I come off stage and, you know, kind of depressed, but loving to play music anyway, and the waitress says that fellow over there with his wife, he'd like a word with you.
Mm.
So I go over the table and he stands up and he introduces himself. He says, "My name's L. Russell Brown. I wrote 'Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree.'"
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, how nice for you. And
right,
know,
right.
You know, and he said, but he was one of these crazy guys, you know, and I liked him immediately anyway. And he said, "You know, Vera," he said, "you're one of the great singers. You're one of the great songwriters." He said, "but you never make any money."
Mm.
He said, "everybody knows how great you are." He said, "me, I make a lot of money, but I don't get the respect like you get."
Right.
And I think, what is this guy, the Rodney Dangerfield of rock and roll?
Yeah, he gets no respect, yeah.
Yeah, he gets no respect, you know?
Yeah.
So he said, but I got an idea while I was watching you up there. He said, you and I should write together. I could teach you how to make money, and you could teach me how to get respect.
Mm.
Well, that sounded like a good bargain to me, so I started over to his house. You know, and like everybody that's successful at one thing, and Larry was a very successful songwriter. He wrote "Come On, Mary Ann" for the Four Seasons. You know, good stuff.
Mm, that's a good one too. Yep, all good ones. Yep, all good ones.
Yeah, so he wanted to be a producer, so he manages somehow to get a gig producing for Nancy Sinatra.
Mm.
Not at a great period in her career at that time, but at any rate, it's a gig. And so he said, look, I need one more song for Nancy. He said, let's write something. He said, I got to go to the beauty parlor and pick up my wife. He says, you get something started and we'll finish it when I come back. So I'm thinking, what the hell do I write for Nancy Sinatra? Oh,
right.
She has this famous father. So I'm writing lines like, I love my daddy, but it really don't matter what my daddy might say, you know, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And before Larry gets back, I had the song finished. So I play it for him, and he loves it. He loves it. And he says, man, he said, that's the number one song if I ever heard one.
Mm.
He said, I'm going to play it for Nancy. I said, great, let's do it. So he plays it for her next day or something, and she didn't like it. So now Larry's pissed.
Right.
You know? And he says, man, you got to prove me right and prove her wrong. He said, you got to do something with this song. So my friend had a little country band and with a girl singer. She had a nice voice, but she was lazy and didn't learn it very well.
Mm.
So we recorded it, and everywhere we went, love the song, hate the girl. Love the song, hate the girl.
Right.
So finally, the last guy on my list says, love the song, hate the girl, but, and that was the first time we got a but, he said, but we're recording Dolly next week. He said, let me have the song for her. I said, you got it, brother. Just give me some money.
Yeah.
So I figured he's going to give me a couple of $100. And I had my little girlfriend with me at the time in his office. And, you know, his secretary comes, he signs his name on the check and puts it in an envelope, licks it. So we're going down in the elevator, and she couldn't wait any longer. She grabs the envelope out of my hand and rips it open. She says, holy F, baby.
Yeah.
She said, he gave you $2,500. Now, that was a fortune in 1978, you know?
Yeah.
So I said, I guess he was serious. So the song comes out, and at that time I got an offer to move to California and write songs for Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in my car with everything I owned, and I'm driving all across the country, and every 20 minutes, man, they're playing my song.
Wow.
Every 20 minutes. And I said, man,
how cool.
I'm back in showbiz, you know?
Yeah. What an exciting
and
ride.
And the song went to number one, man.
What an exciting ride you had.
No, it was cool. Boy, it was a hell of a ride out there. 3,000 miles.
But I'm sure every time you heard it, you stepped on the gas a little more.
Baby, let me tell you.
Uh-huh.
And you know
Thank
what?
God.
Before I moved, at the time things were so bad, I was living with my mother. And so one day I get a phone call, and it was Dolly's assistant.
Mm.
And she said, you know, Dolly would love to meet the man who wrote this beautiful song.
Wow.
I said, well, you know, we figured out when she was playing somewhere on the East Coast.
Mm.
And the closest was in Maryland. So I drove down to Maryland. Had my 12-year-old daughter at the time with me, and we got to hang out with Dolly all day.
Very nice.
I'll tell you one thing. She is the nicest person I ever met in show business.
She seems that way. She really does.
She
seems
exactly
genuine.
What she seems.
She does. Yep,
exactly.
She seems genuine. Yep.
Oh, yeah. And I've met her many times over the years since then.
Right.
We had the same manager when At This Moment was hot. So I'd see
Wow.
her. You know,
well, what I got to play it for everybody. This is,
oh,
I really got
do.
A feeling. Yes, I really got a feeling by Dolly Parton, written by Billy. So enjoy this one, too.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. So that, what was that, around 78? And then that kind of like kicked you back into gear, right? You're then
yeah,
in the
it,
80s. That, yeah.
It hit number one on in 79, January. And that was the day I reached L.A.
Wow.
I said, wow, I'm back in showbiz again, you know?
You're right. Oh, man. And I got to ask, how did your relationship with Lou Rawls begin? How did that all come about?
Oh, that came about. One of my best friends from all my years in show business, a fellow named Michael Cuscuna, who's a
mm-hmm.
great jazz producer. And he was working for Blue Note Records, the great jazz label.
Mm-hmm.
And his boss, Bruce Lundvall, whose birthday it is today.
Oh, happy birthday,
Bruce.
Bruce
is no longer with us, unfortunately.
Oh.
Great man, one of the great record men of our time. Anyway, he took a chance and he signed Lou to the label. And Lou hadn't had a hit in a long time. He had been making what I call Vegas disco records, you know, just
mm-hmm.
terrible records that nobody was buying.
Right.
So Bruce got the idea. He said, let's take Lou back to the kind of music that made him famous in the beginning, the kind of music that people made that loved him for, you know, jazz, blues.
Yeah.
He said, and some of your songs, Billy. So we put together a band, you know, a New York band of Richard T. and Cornell Dupree, all these wonderful musicians that wanted to help Lou make a comeback. So he recorded four songs of mine on the first album and some other great songs. We did a duet with Diane Reeves of At Last.
Mm-hmm.
And the album went to number one on the jazz charts.
Cool.
So, and then we did two more for Blue Note. And he cut some more of my songs and you know, other songs that I picked for him. And they were both those albums were in the top five. So we, you know, Lou had a career again.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, both of you, right? At the same time. Well, yours was already getting back up there, you know, but I mean, listen, you always had a fantastic career, but I know what you mean when you're not getting it, the music out there, you know, when you want to be out there, you know, I know what that means. And
well,
like you said, I'm not making money.
Of your career, you know?
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, like, you know, it was something that I figured out at a very young age that if you do everything that you do well, you know, this year maybe your singing will do better. Next year maybe your songwriting will do better. Next year after that maybe your acting will do better. So at least you got something going all the time.
Right.
And, you know, it's something my mother told me. She said, show business is a business of peaks and valleys.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, so always live below your means. In other words, no matter how much money you make, spend less.
Right.
And because what happens to, you know, artists, people in the arts are generally not very good at business.
Right.
And, you know, they get a hit movie or a hit book or a hit record or a hit TV show, and first thing they do is run out and buy a new house for their mother or buy the big car or something. And, you know, when things go down, they lose that house and they lose that car.
Yeah, and longevity is a hard thing to get in the entertainment industry. You've got to have it or not. And, I mean, you've got it. Lou Rawls is another one we're going to play. But, I mean, you've worked with everybody. You know everybody. I can't believe this. I just great. What an amazing life you've had. I just can't get over it.
Well, and there's the element of luck.
Yeah.
And then there's the element of timing. You know, you might be great, but or you might have something great, a great record, but maybe Elton John comes out with an even bigger record, and so yours doesn't go up to the top because his is there. You know,
well,
so it's, timing is important also.
Well, when I grow up, I want to be Billy Vera, so
yeah.
Anyway. I'm never going to grow up.
What's that joke? The kid says to his father, he said, Dad, I want to be a musician when I grow up. And the father says, well, you can't do both.
Yeah. I actually saw that one recently on Facebook. I was like, I love
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
That's
where
true.
I saw it.
It's so true. Oh, maybe I saw it on your page.
No, not on my page, but I saw it on Facebook somewhere, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, how true is that, right?
Yeah,
oh, my God.
Funny because
it
it's
is.
True.
It is, right? Oh, my God. Well, let's do Room with a View. Let's let everybody hear that in case they've never heard it. Wow, I could find that unbelievable
one.
That they never heard it, but here we go. Room with a View, Lou Rawls, again, written by Billy. Enjoy.
I've got a room. I've got a room with a view. I've got a room. I've got a room with a view. I've got a house full of troubles and a room with a view of the blue. On my wall, just a ceiling above my head. No rugs on my floor, no pillow on my bed. I got a room. I've got a room with a view. I've got a house full of trouble and a room with a view of the blue. Now these old walls, they are closing in on me. These old walls, they are closing in on me. There ain't no food in my icebox. I don't even have a TV. Now the ceiling's getting so low, it's about to touch the floor. The blues keeps on knocking, knocking on my door. I've got a room. I got a room with a view. And I've got a house full of worries. Whoa! And a room with a view of the blue.
About you, your versatility. My God, you could write anything, anything.
You know,
oh my
God. It was such a perfect song for him, as it turned out, because he can hit those deep, low notes with that big voice of his.
Right, right,
you know?
Right. Oh, man. Oh, yeah, I mean, just from jazz to pop to country. I mean, you do it all. You do it all. Are you writing
well,
now?
Well, my tastes are very broad, you know.
Right, right.
And
are
I
you
thank
writing
my
now
mother
or
for that again.
Right, thank God, right, because she had music in the house for you and all the different styles and everything.
Yeah.
Now, are you writing now or are you pretty much retired?
I'm as a writer, I'm pretty much retired, you know, because there's really... who am I writing for, you know? That's the problem.
Not for these people these days.
No, no.
You know? Sad to say. What do you think of today's music? And what do you think of today's music? I definitely don't think it has the longevity that we've had in our lifetime.
I don't care for it very much.
Me either.
I find myself going back, not ahead. Like lately, I've been listening to a lot of early Louis Armstrong.
Oh,
like
wow!
Like the records he made in the 30s.
Yep. Yep.
You know, like if you ever want to hear something that'll blow your mind, listen.
Turn me on. I'll listen.
Go
to
YouTube and type in Louis Armstrong Stardust.
Stardust. I think
between his singing and his trumpet playing, it's like it's genius. You know. A lot of them get real corny with their stuff. You know, Hello Dolly's great, but his version of a genius like him with a great song like Stardust, and magic happens.
I'm gonna check out his version.
Yeah, dig it, man,
because
it's just and there's a lot of things that good by him from that period, that early period.
Right. Wow.
In fact,
I
recorded one of the songs that he made famous. I did when Michael Bublé recorded At This Moment.
Mm-hmm.
He sold like 14 million records. So,
of course, it's your song. It's a great song.
The first check paid for my dream album. I always wanted to make a big band album.
Yeah.
So I said, but how can I make my big band album different than everybody else's?
Mm.
And somebody said to me, a friend of mine, I said, well, what do you know better than anybody else? You know black music.
Right.
I said, yeah. So I said, that's a great idea. I'll record songs written by the great black songwriters of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s.
Mm.
So one of the ones I picked was Armstrong's theme song, When It's Sleepy Time Down South.
Mm.
And it's a great song. We had a great arrangement of it, and got played on all the jazz stations, you know.
Mm.
And I know Joe Pesci, the actor, you know.
Yeah.
And every time he's in town, he comes to see me sing, and he always says, he says, man, you're going to do Sleepy Time tonight for me. So I always do it, and I dedicate it to Joe. Another Jersey boy, you know, talking about Jersey.
Yeah. Well, he's supposedly, I don't know if this is true, you would know, he had a pretty big hand in the Four Seasons. I think he got them together to some degree. No, am I wrong on that?
He was friends with Frankie as a kid,
yeah.
You know. And
right.
they used to go together to see Little Jimmy Scott, the great jazz singer.
Mm.
And they both were idolized Jimmy. He and Frankie were friends, and you know, Joey helped them out a little bit, and when they were getting started, and then he went in. He was in Joey D's Starlighters for a while.
Mm.
And
I love,
you know,
Joey D. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Joey called me up on Sunday. He said there was an oldie show out in Westbury, Long Island.
Yeah.
And he said all the cast, all the acts got together at the end of the show for a finale, and they sang I Believe in tribute to Larry Chance. He said there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Yeah, I would have cried myself. I mean, I saw Joey a couple months ago too. I don't remember the name of that show, but yeah, that had a bunch of different acts as well. And Joey still kicking it. Oh man, he's doing that twist unbelievable.
I know,
Crazy,
and he and I, we
crazy.
Go back to the Peppermint Lounge days together.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah,
oh,
we've been
my
friends
God.
Forever.
I know.
He's a good guy, another good guy.
Yep, yeah, another sweetheart. He really is. Yep, he's a great guy. Now, what I want to ask you, now we did Lou Rawls, right? So then Bonnie Raitt decided to do Papa Come Quick in 91. So that must have blew your mind.
Well, I knew her. We were on the board of directors of the Rhythm and Blues Foundation together. I was there for about 10 years, you know, helping old rhythm and blues acts that have fallen on hard times.
Yeah.
And so one day she calls me up. She said she had just made her big album, Nick of Time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, man, they want me to do another album right away. You know, I don't have enough songs. You got anything for me? So I always liked the way she sang ballads. So I put together a tape of, you know, two or three maybe ballads. And I was on the phone with Michael Cuscuna, the guy I produced Lou Rawls with, and his wife was eavesdropping on our conversation. And he said, and she said, rather, she said, what about that little Cajun song you got? That'd be great for Bonnie. I said, well, I don't know, man. It's about a bunch of southern rednecks, you know, and I don't know if Bonnie could relate to that. No, you got to do it. You got to. So she talked me into it, so I put it on the end of the tape. And, of course, they needed a fast song. They didn't need another ballad. And so Bonnie says, I want to do that song, Papa Come Quick. So she said, then she gets to the studio a couple of weeks later, and she calls me from the studio. And she says, man, I can't get my band to play the way your demo is, you know.
Mm.
So she said, can you come over here and help me? And she said, bring your guitar. So I said, okay, I'll be right over. So I bring my Telecaster and, you know, and I plug it, and I listen to the way they're playing it. And I said, yeah. I said, here, the problem is your musicians are too good. You know, I mean, they got to play simpler. They got to make it really kind of dumb.
Right.
And so I told the drummer, I said, just play thump, thump, thump on your bass drum. Don't even touch the rest of your drums. And I told the bass player the same thing. And then I played my dopey little chords that I play, you know. And then we made the record.
Yeah.
And the album did about 5 or 6 million copies. And it was the biggest album she ever made. And she did a great job on it.
Yeah, I know. I love it. I love it. Well, do you want to play that one? Let's play it.
Oh, please do. Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, this is Papa Come Quick. It's Bonnie Raitt singing, written by Billy again. And I hope you guys are having as much fun as I am. My smile has not gone down since we started this conversation. I'm in heaven speaking with you tonight, Billy.
Cool.
Thank you again so much for hanging out with me. I appreciate
it. My pleasure.
All right, Papa Come Quick, Bonnie Raitt, written by Billy Vera.
Papa Come Quick, Jody's gone to the city. What are we gonna do now that Jody's gone? She left a note on the TV and Papa, it's so pretty. What are we gonna do now that Jody's gone? Morning, she cried right through as the world turned. one papa, it's a bitchin'. Let's all ask before the baby gets burned.
Great story. Great story. Oh,
that's
man.
A good one. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
I'm listening to the words, you know, it brought back where some of them came from.
I was
going to
ask
player.
If there's a story behind it. Is there a story behind it or no?
Well, not entirely. I wrote that. I have to say this. I wrote that with two other people, Chip Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And Chip and I were writing songs together for my follow-up album.
Mm-hmm.
And we made some demos over at my guitar player's house, and that was Ricky Hirsch, who had been a member of Wet Willie years
mm-hmm.
ago, before
mm-hmm.
he was with my band. And so Ricky said, I wrote a song, man. You want to hear it? And he starts playing this guitar lick, and there's no song. It's just a guitar lick. So Chip and I wrote the rest of the song around his lick. And Ricky's girlfriend had a daughter named Jody.
Mm.
And I liked the sound of it, so I said, you know,
yeah.
Papa, come quick, Jody's gone to the city, you know. And then later on in the song, I had a bass player that used to say, what the hell's a ding-dang deal? And I said, well, that's a cool thing. Let me throw that in there, you know. So, you know, stuff comes from different places.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah, great story, and she does it great. Oh my God, oh my. Well, Bonnie,
there's a video
phenomenal.
On YouTube of her doing it with on stage with Alison Krauss.
Oh, I'll have to check that out too.
Yeah, check it out. Yeah, make a list now.
Yeah, I've got one already. I got it.
I'm
already.
Giving you homework,
you
girl.
Oh, come on. I hate school. Well, if it's music, I'm cool. Yeah, I'm going to check it out. And I wanted to ask you, oh, God, was that you doing background vocals too?
I don't think so. I don't remember if I did or not. I'm not generally a background singer, so it might not be me.
Well, I figured since she got you in there, dragged you in there to fix it up and make it right, you know,
yeah.
I figured maybe that was you too on there.
You know, the funny thing was,
like
the funny thing was the producer, you know, he's supposed to be the producer, and he's just, I looked in the window, and I just saw him up there with his feet up on the console, you know. So, actually, I was producing the song.
Right, right.
But, you know, I said,
you
know what,
everything.
I don't care about a credit for producing, man. I just want to get my song on the album, you know.
Oh, my God.
That's what really matters.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Well, I don't know which way to go with this, because, all right, well, let's talk about... I wanted to talk about your books. Any new books in the works or no?
Well, I had three, you know, people had always asked me, they say, you tell such great stories. Why don't you write a book, an autobiography? I said, oh, man, you know. So my lawyer, you know, hooked me up with a couple of agents, book agents.
Yeah.
They all said,
mm-hmm.
you're not a big enough name. Nobody's going to buy a book by you.
Oh, get out.
So this lady friend of mine, she said, your stories are so good, just write the damn book, and I'll take care of the agenting. I'll sell it.
Right.
So I sat down and I just wrote it. And luckily, I kept all my date books over the years, and so it's perfectly accurate.
Yeah, your experiences are just music history. You're a music historian just based on that. I mean, in your experiences in your life. I mean, it's just amazing.
And that's called Harlem to Hollywood.
Yeah.
And then another friend, a director friend of mine, he directed a movie also called Harlem to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on Amazon Prime and on Tubi. You can find it on there. And there's some great footage of me and Judy Clay at the Apollo on stage.
Oh,
and you never, you know, which is really talk about history, you never see Apollo footage on anybody. It's just in those days, nobody thought that our music was that important to be preserved. You know, nobody, that's just kid music, you know.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Same.
And then I was asked to write a, I did a lot of, historical work for a company called Specialty Records.
Mm-hmm.
They discovered Little Richard and Sam Cooke and Lloyd Price and all these people. So this publisher asked me to write a book about the record company.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called Rip It Up, the Specialty Record Story.
Right.
If you have any interest in the black music of the 40s and the 50s, this is the real inside story of how things were done.
Yeah, and this is the book for you, folks. Rip It Up.
Specialty Record Story. And then so somebody said, well, you know, I woke up one morning after I wrote those two. I woke up one morning with a scene in my head.
Mm.
Like, and I said, my God, it was like this really complex little scene. I said, man, that would make a great scene in a movie. Oh, wait, maybe I could write a book. And then so little by little, I wrote that scene out. And then little by little, these characters kept, as if they were knocking on my door, ringing my doorbell, I want to be in your book, you know?
No, cool.
And I don't mean literally people, but, you know,
yeah, musicians, people. Famous musicians during that time, yeah. Wow.
No, this is not about musicians, per se.
Oh, it's about the record company.
This is a novel. This is a novel.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was the story about Specialty Records. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's Rip It Up. That's Rip It
Up.
Yeah.
No, so what's
the other
one?
I'm talking about the third book now.
Oh, what's the third book?
The third book is I decided to write a fiction, a novel. And it's about a guy who's like around 65 years old. He's a musician. He's been a guitar player. And, you know, he's got to keep working because he's not rich. So he takes a job playing for Bonnie Raitt, you know. And one night, the book opens up. He at a gig in Austin, Texas. He meets this 19-year-old little rich girl from the rich part of Connecticut, Greenwich, Connecticut, and they get together. And just as the night after their romance. She's watching television. He's taking a shower, and he hears her scream. And he runs in there, dripping wet, and she's crying and watching the television. And they just found out that the city of Los Angeles just got destroyed by an atomic bomb.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And so he gets a call from his uncle, Nicky, from New Orleans, who's the head of the mafia in New Orleans. And I won't tell you any more about it, but it's a story, you know, and it's called a dollop of toothpaste.
Does the mafia save the day?
In a way, yes. Save the country, yeah.
A dollop of toothpaste. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know about that one.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Wow.
One's in audio as well as a book form.
Oh, that's great. I prefer audio. I have no time to read. You know, if
yeah,
I can throw headphones
can
on,
car,
I'm good.
You know, whatever.
Yeah, or in the car. Yep.
Listen to it in the car.
Great. Well, I did want to ask you, speaking of Larry earlier, who approached you about doing Stand By Me? Because I love what you guys do with it.
Well, here's what happened. You know, as I said, we were friends for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
We talk late at night on the phone, just like me and Joey D talk late at night
right.
on the phone to this day. And I got an offer to play at my old high school in White Plains.
Oh.
We had a beautiful theater there. So I said, I'll do a show there. And so in advance of the show, I had to do one of these interviews like I'm doing with you, only with somebody not as talented as you.
Oh, you're too kind.
And this guy was going to be the MC of the show. And I said, my God, I can't have this idiot introduce me. He'll get it all wrong. So I call up Larry, and I said, hey, Larry, what are you doing that night? You know, he said, well, what do you need, brother? I said, well, man, would you introduce me that night? You know my life. You know my story. You know what to say. So he said, yeah, baby, I'm there for you, you know. So he comes, he gives me this beautiful, you know, Larry would always tell everybody that Billy Vera is my idol, you know.
Yeah.
And so he got out there and he gave me his flowery introduction. It was lovely, and all my old homies from high school were in the audience, you know, like
nice,
1,000 people there, sold out house. So I did my little show, and at the end of the show, I bring Larry out, and we did an impromptu version of Stand By Me.
Mm.
And we got a standing ovation. And so a couple of days later, after I got home, maybe a week later, he calls me up. He says, you know, I cut a track on Stand By Me, man. He said, how would you feel about putting your voice on it? We'd do it as a duet. I said, oh, Larry. I said, the world don't need another version of Stand By Me. Benny's record is untoppable. He said, oh, no, just take a listen to the track, man, and I think you're going to like it. So, you know, I said, okay, I'll listen. He sends it out to me, and I said, holy moly.
Yeah.
I said, this sounds like Count Basie doing Stand By Me.
I know, it's great. I know. When he gave
so
it to me, I was
said,
like, wow.
Yeah, give me the tape. I'll cut it. I'll record it over at my sax player's house. You know?
I loved it when he sent it to me, because I didn't know you guys did it either together.
Yeah.
When you just told me that story, I had tears in my eyes with you guys over doing that song together in the intro. And
Man, yeah. So the next thing you know, man, you know, I had a few connections. I played it for Mike Stoller of Lieber and Stoller, one of the writers of the song. And he said, man, I love this record. He said, this is as good as the record we made with Benny.
Mm.
He said, I got this girl who works for me. Her job is to try to get our songs in movies and commercials and stuff like that. He said, I'm going to put her to work on this. So, you know, that hasn't happened yet. But, you know, the record's being played on jazz stations all over the country. And so there we are, you know, me 79 and Larry 82, and we got a record on the radio.
Oh, man. And it's great. It really
is. It really is. I'm really proud of it. And Larry was, too.
When he played, I said, Larry, what a twist. I mean, wow. I would never expect it. But, and it was great. We
me
played
either, because, I mean, it changed my mind about doing the song on the record.
Right.
Because it was such a unique... A unique reimagining of the song.
Yeah, I'd love to play it if you don't mind.
I wish you would.
Oh,
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, guys, this is Stand By Me with Billy Vera and the late, great Larry Chance from Larry Chance and the Earls. Rest his soul. He literally passed about a week ago. And
God bless him.
Beautiful guy. Yep, God bless him is right. Enjoy. You are going to love this.
When the night has come, and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. I won't be afraid, just as long. Come on and stand by me. And if the sky we look upon should tumble and fall, the mountains should crumble to the sea, let me tell you, darling, I won't cry. I won't cry. Why? I won't shed a tear. Just as long as you stand by me, pretty little darling, won't you stand by me? I want you to stand by me, oh darling, stand by me. We'll
We stand by you, Larry, forever. Well,
God
what a
bless
great
him.
Version. Yes, wonderful guy. I wish I'd known him as long as you did. I really do.
Oh, what a wonderful guy. You know, he and I had, we were like brothers under the skin, man. He was, he and I had a lot of the same taste musically. Again, broad taste. And I remember when we found out that we both loved Arthur Prysock. You know who Arthur was?
No, that name's not ringing a bell.
You know who Billy Eckstein was, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, Arthur was like similar voice, you know. Everybody knows how you know, one of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And Arthur had the luxury of having a great band leader. He worked for Buddy Johnson. Buddy wrote Since I Fell for You and all these great songs.
Mm-hmm.
And so Arthur was a very handsome guy. So you know what happens when you're too good-looking and, you know, the guys hate you and the girls like you. Well, in Arthur's case, what Buddy did was he would write songs for Arthur that where he loses the girl. So the women wanted to mother him, and the guys said, oh, man, yeah, if Arthur could lose the girl, then I don't feel so bad.
Right. Oh,
so it, career-wise, it worked really well for him.
Right.
And you know Arthur name? Ended up recording.
Arthur what?
Prysock.
Prysock.
His brother was Red Prysock, the great saxophone player.
I'm going to look that up, too.
Who made hand clapping. But Arthur, toward the end of his life, he recorded At This Moment. He did a version of that, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which was a big thrill. I got to meet him and everything.
Oh, cool. I'm definitely going to look him up, too. What are you giving me all this homework for at 11 o'clock at night? What the heck? Come on now. You're lucky I'm off tomorrow. I'm kidding.
Yeah, man.
I do have the day off tomorrow, so I will be up listening to music and stuff. So I can't
Good.
Wait to check out everything. Yeah.
Good.
And I don't know if everybody knows this, how they won't know, but you also wrote, and I know at least two, Empty Nest, the theme song, and the theme song to King of Queens. Two of my favorite. Two were great shows. Great shows.
Yeah, great shows. And Empty Nest, I think, was on 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And King of Queens was on for 9 years.
Yeah,
and
that's a funny show.
As we speak, it's on somewhere.
Yeah, it's always on.
And you know, you
get Empty Nest. I don't see much of it. They should bring.
No,
that back,
they don't
too.
Play that one much anymore.
Yeah.
But King of Queens, like on Saturday nights, man, I see it on cable like it's on seven or eight times in a row.
Right.
Yeah.
You
get paid for that.
Of course. Yeah.
You get residuals, and it's like having a hit record, man. I mean,
right.
Those checks
now,
just keep coming.
Are you in L.A. or New York?
L.A.
Oh, okay. So the one night you said you were watching Perry Mason, and I got to go. Perry Mason's on. I'm like, well, Perry Mason's coming on about 1 a.m. here, so are you watching the same channel I'm watching?
Well, it's called MeTV.
Yes, that's what I was watching, MeTV.
And it comes on at 11:30 here.
Oh, okay, around here. I think it could be around 1 or 1:30.
Yeah, right after Carol Burnett.
Oh, another great show, right? Oh,
boy. And, you know, they got away with a lot of stuff that wouldn't pass today.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
You know, yeah, so she's such a genius, comic
genius. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's 22 album recordings, 12 singles, 4 theme songs for music and TV, 3 books now, I thought it was 2, 3 books, and writing music for every musician under the sun, including yourself. I mean, and plus acting. What, did you ever think you'd be an actor, get into acting?
No,
I mean,
not at all. I had no desire to be an actor whatsoever.
Right.
One night, this is 1980, we're playing the Troubadour, and Chip Taylor's brother, John Voight, comes in to see me with the band.
Right.
With his acting coach, who was a fellow named David Provall, who you might remember from The Sopranos.
Yep.
He was married to Tony Soprano's sister, and David was also in Mean Streets. He played the bartender. Anyway, he's an acting coach. So they come backstage after the show, and John, I hadn't seen him in years. He says, "You know, Billy," he said, I was watching you up there all night." He said, "Man," he said, "you do something I've never seen a singer do." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, most singers sing at an audience. You know, hey, you all, hello, L.A., great to see you, and all that bullshit." Excuse me. Excuse my mouth.
You can say whatever you want.
Oh, good. Then I'll get really dirty now.
I speak French, too. That's okay.
So he said, "Anyway, I've never seen anybody do." He said, "You work from like an actor, man, from the inside out." He said, "You should be an actor." I said, "Oh, John, I'm not good-looking enough to be an actor like you, man." He said, no. "Some of the greatest actors are not, you know, matinee idols." He said, "You should come to David's class." Oh, come on, John, I don't want to do that.
Right.
So he could be very persuasive. So I show up one night to the class, and I'm waiting to be sold on it, you know.
Mm.
And the first guys I see up on stage, this guy Chris Mulkey, I never forget, and this other guy, Rocky Echeverria, who became Stephen Bauer.
Oh.
I don't know if you saw Ray Donovan, the series.
Oh, God. Probably reruns.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, John's in it, and Stephen Bauer plays his sidekick.
Yeah.
So I watch these guys. I said, "Oh, man, this is not bullshit. I mean, these guys are really doing some art up there on that stage. I mean, I gotta learn this." So I kept going back, but I wouldn't get up there. I mean, I was a little scared to get up there.
Mm.
And finally I got up, and little by little I learned how to do it. And then finally I got asked to be in some plays, and then I got asked to be on a couple of TV shows, and then I got the movie Buckaroo Banzai. And then we had some slow years in L.A. too. You know, between our first Billy and the Beaters hit, I could take care of myself. The record company went out of business, so I was eking out a living as an actor, you know. So it came in handy, to say the
least. Well, you are a utility. I can't speak.
Utility man.
Thank you. Thank you for getting it out of my mouth.
I help you.
You could do anything. My goodness. My goodness. Well, if you do a book, you definitely need to. I would read it. I definitely would, about your life, because, I mean,
we'll read it. It's called Harlem to Hollywood.
No, you said you wanted to do another one.
No. I pretty much covered everything in Harlem to Hollywood.
Okay, then I'm going to get, I'm going to do the audio version of it, I believe, I was going to do.
Version of that. You were going to do the audio version of the novel.
Of a dollop of toothpaste, yeah.
Dollop of toothpaste. There's
right,
no
right.
audio version of Rip It Up, but you got to read
up.
That.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to check them out for sure. But,
cool.
Oh, my God. Billy, it has been an absolute honor hanging out with you tonight. I mean, you are music royalty in my eyes and in every musician's eyes for sure, because your career is just gone full circle. You've done it all. You've written for everyone, and oh my God! So,
and I'm still singing, man. We had a gig last night.
Did you? Where'd you play?
Herb Alpert owns a club called Herb Alpert's Vibrato. It's like way up at the top of the hills in the Hollywood Hills. Beautiful,
nice.
beautiful club. Perfect, as you can imagine, with all his money. Perfect acoustics and sound system.
Yeah.
And I was there with my 18-piece band.
Wow.
And so, you know, in a club like that, you get a lot of Hollywood people. You know, Priscilla Presley comes to see us.
Yeah.
And Lisa Gibbons, you remember her? She was there last night. And Frida Payne came to see me last night.
I've been trying to get Frida on the show. She said she was coming, and I said, okay, let's make a date. Let's make a date. And she never got back to me. So
You keep trying. You keep trying her, man. She'll do it. She's a good egg, and she's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, my only contact with her is on Facebook, so maybe she doesn't read her messages. She read it once. She said, email me. I did. She said, okay, let's set it up. And
you just got to keep after her. She's very busy.
Yeah, I love
her. Don't give up, because she's a good interview, man, because she has an autobiography, too.
Yeah.
And boy, she tells a lot of stories I wouldn't tell.
Oh, I bet she's got some good ones. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, you know,
oh,
she was so beautiful in her day, man, and she dated Quincy Jones. I mean, you name it. She knew them, you know, and all the guys were in love with her, man.
Oh, well, we loved their music, too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So. Well, let's get to the big one that everybody, if they didn't know about your entire amazing career, this one definitely stands out for this generation, I think. This one is monumental, and this one will live forever, too, at this moment.
Thank God.
I mean, yeah. And now, any story behind that or just another written? Because you wrote that one for yourself.
It's a pretty good one, in fact. I was still living at my mother's in 1977, and I was playing at a club periodically up in Pleasantville, you know, the home of Reader's Digest. And I look out in the audience one night, and I see these two couples, and this one beautiful girl, and she's sitting with a guy. You could tell they're not together, really. And the other couple was tight. They were together.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh, my God. I almost stumbled on the words of my song. She was so beautiful. And so I come off stage. I said, who was that? They said, oh, that's Nina. She used to waitress here sometimes. She's in college. And so I played there again about a month later, and she showed up by herself, and somebody introduced us, and we started dating.
Oh.
So she tells me the story about breaking up with the dude that she had been with the night I saw her, and how he was so crushed, and he almost went into suicidal, you know, a terrible crush.
Yeah, yeah.
At least the way she described it.
Right, right.
So I'm back home at my mother's house at the piano, and I wrote two-thirds of the song from what I perceived as his point of view. This guy's so crushed.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't finish it. I couldn't figure out how to end it. So usually when that happens, I just throw the song away. And thank God I didn't throw the song away. But I put it in my mother's piano bench, and then a year later when she broke up with me, then I knew how that felt.
Oh, there you go.
I knew how that felt, and I finished the song.
Wow.
So that was that. And then that song helped me get out to L.A. with Warner Brothers.
Does she know that song's about her or what?
Oh, yeah, she did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You still in touch with her?
Huh? I was for a long time. Well, she passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't know this, that she had. See, I was 33 and she was 20 at the time we met. And you know, she stayed in touch with me for a long time. She didn't, when she broke up with me, I guess she thought she was just too young to get that deeply involved with somebody, and she didn't date for a long time at all. You know, a lot of people think that a lot of guys especially, they think that the girl that breaks up with them is going to go out with 100 guys. But that's not always the case, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't go out with anybody. You know?
Right, right, right. It's just the time.
Anyway, so we stayed in contact, and you know, the first time At This Moment came out, it was a follow-up to I Can Take Care of Myself.
Mm-hmm.
And on the album, I had the guy in the studio scratch her name into the vinyl, you know. And I sent her the album, and I told her that I did that. You know, I was hoping against hope that I'd get her back someday, which I did not. And so the record came out, what happened was the promotion man from the record company quit. He had a fight with the boss, and there was nobody to promote the record, so it only went up to number 79.
So at then, the time, yeah.
Yeah, the first time. This is in 81.
Right.
And then, you know, we were without a record deal. You know, by that time I'm 36 years old and too old to be a rock and roll star. And that's when the acting picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years later, I get a phone call one day, because I always kept my number in the phone book in case I might miss something. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I always figured anybody, the kind of person that would bother me is too stupid to look me up.
Right, it's true.
You know, it's true. I mean, I wouldn't recommend that for a girl, but for a guy, you know, that's the way it was. Anyway, so the guy calls me up. He says, my name's Michael Whitehorn, and I produce a show called Family Ties, and I'm one of the writers. He said, we were at the club the other night. We heard you sing this beautiful song that we think might be perfect for an episode we have coming up where Michael J. Fox meets the love of his life.
Right.
So I said, yeah, we'll call Warner Brothers and license the song from them.
Right.
So they do, and I get a bag full of mail. Now, I had had songs on TV shows before.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually it's in the background, and, you know, nobody hears it. But this time I got mail. And I said, wow, maybe this song actually has something. Because I didn't think it was a commercial song. You know, I thought it was too something.
Well,
you know,
it
didn't have
a
title that people remember. You know, nobody ever remembers the title.
At the time, the show was almost like a music video for it. So that's and there's a big viewership. So that's the two clicked, and there you go. So
what happened was I went to a couple of record companies to see if they'd let me re-record the song. Nobody was interested.
Right.
And then I was friends with the guy that owned Rhino Records. They put out oldies but goodies.
Mm.
And I told him the story, and he said, oh, man. He said, I'll put out an album of your stuff that you recorded for that label. I'll license it from them. So by the time they got it out, we missed the rerun. But then the following season, they do an episode where the girl breaks up with Michael J. Fox.
Right.
And that time, the story of the song, Boy Loses Girl, is the same as the story of the episode, Boy Loses
Exactly.
Girl. And this time, America went berserk. And NBC told us that they had more phone calls and letters than in any time in the history of the network for a song. And people started calling radio stations and record stores, and where can we get this song, blah, blah. And little by little, it just leapt up the charts.
Yeah.
We're jumping over Madonna and all these people, Bon Jovi.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, 42 years old, I got the number one record in the country, man.
You can't complain about that.
Changed
I remember
my
the
life,
episode.
Baby.
Yeah, I remember the episode, and you just talking about it, I got a little bit of a chill in me because it was so heart wrenching, especially you know. You've grown to love this character, and you see his heartbreak. You know, he finally found love, and so again, it was sort of like a video to the song, so which made it work.
And you know, and they're still married in real life.
Yes, yeah.
Children and everything, even with his disease and everything.
Yep.
Yeah, and you know, Jimmy Fallon would have them on the show, he'd have the band play At This Moment. and one time I think he said, you know, he said every time we go into a club or a restaurant where they got a band, they start playing At This Moment. He said I'm sick of At This Moment.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh my God.
But you know,
the
song has done so much. Like a lot of times when people are on those contest shows, you know, where they like to sing that one because it's emotional.
Yeah.
And also Dancing with the Stars, they often do that.
I'm not gonna lie, I did it in karaoke about 30 years ago.
Oh man, that's funny.
Exactly.
That's funny. Speaking of karaoke, there's a famous porn star named Julia Ann.
Okay.
And I kind of know her. She was a fan of mine.
Okay.
And so she called me up one day, and she said, you know, every Tuesday night, there's a club out here in the Valley where they do porn star karaoke.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. She said, they come up there every night. Somebody comes up there and mutilates your song.
Oh, you know? God.
She said, you ought to come. You ought to come out and as a surprise, get up there and sing your own song.
Blow them away.
Oh, Julie, I can't do that.
You'd blow them away.
She said, no, you'll go. There's all the great porn stars are there.
Well, wait a minute. Can we talk about the hookers and now porn stars? Billy, come on.
No.
I'm kidding.
There's nothing dirty about it at all.
I know. I'm only kidding. No, that but, you knew these hookers and now you know these porn stars. I'm only kidding.
So I said, I'll do it if you introduce me.
Mm.
So I go there, and you know, and all these and the place is packed to the gills, you know.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, and the boss turns out was a fan of mine, the guy that owned the club. So she gets up there, introduces me. I go up there and I sing my song, and all these little porn stars are going, "Ooh, I love that song!" You know? It was hilarious, you know.
Oh my God! Oh. Well, listen, we've got like 10 minutes left. I want to get this one in and have a nice farewell with you. So let's do it.
This
is At This Moment by Billy Vera and the Beaters, but it's just Billy. Billy Vera, folks. Check it out.
What did you think I would do at this moment, when you're standing before me with tears in your eyes, trying to tell me that you found you another, you just don't love me no more. I would say at this moment, when I'm faced with the knowledge that you just don't love me, would you think I would curse you or say things to hurt you? 'Cause you just don't love me no more. Come on, you know me too well. How could I hurt you when, darling, I love you, and you know I've never hurt you. What do you think I would give at this moment? Subtract 20 years from my life. I'd fall down on my knees, kiss the ground that you walk on, if I could just hold you again.
Really got a hold on you. Oh, boy.
You know,
oh,
the funny thing, not funny, but the sad thing, when my book, Harlem to Hollywood, came out, you know, it was getting reviewed in all these, all over the country.
Yeah.
And a fellow from the Wall Street Journal did a review, and he had all the, you know, research people, and he wanted to find out who Nina was and all that.
Yeah.
He tracked down the widower, the husband, and the guy told her. He said, yeah, she passed away a year ago.
Mm.
He said, you know, I knew, you know, she told me that the song was written for her and you know, all that.
Yeah.
Ironically, she married a brain surgeon.
Wow.
And she died of something to do with her brain.
Her brain. Wow.
Yeah. Talk about,
well, I've
got to
tell you, I'm very curious about her, too, now that you told me the story.
Well, she was a very, you know what, the best way to describe, we were like Bogey and Bacall.
Mm.
She was very much like Lauren Bacall.
Mm.
You know, she was. She had that same kind of look. You know, that sultry,
yeah,
kind of look and that,
yeah,
sultry voice. Very, very smart. I mean, she was 20 going on 35. If you know what I mean.
Wow.
My mother loved her, and my mother wasn't crazy about a lot of girls I dated.
But most
she
mothers aren't. Most mothers
aren't. And my daughter loved Nina also.
Ah. Oh,
yeah.
Sweet.
So it was. It was. And you know, the funny thing was, my father's second wife was 13 years younger.
Oh,
my,
wow.
My grandfather's second wife was 13 years younger.
Wow.
So I thought it was an omen that we were meant to,
yeah,
be.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, shows,
hmm,
you what I know. So much,
right,
for omens.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
But, yeah,
well,
I mean,
Billy,
she was literally the love of my life.
Yeah. Well, that song just says it all. Oh, my God. And I didn't play the long version, the one where you really go way out at the end.
Yeah,
know, really,
yeah.
Yeah. I love that one, too. Yeah. I just almost sang it, but it's late. I can't. I have music Tourette's. A song gets in my head, and I got to get singing, or it'll be with me forever.
And sometimes it's not always the songs that you like that stick in your head.
I know. Don't you hate those? Oh, my God.
I hate that.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. I know.
Can't get rid of it.
Well, my God, it has been an honor and a pleasure to have you back on. I know you don't remember, and how could you? You've been on a million shows since probably the 60s. And, my God, please come back anytime. I would love to hang out with you again. And,
great.
Oh, God,
well,
I wish I was in
know.
L.A. I wish I was in L.A. I'd come out and see you. Oh, I'd come and see,
yeah,
you perform.
We,
oh,
sure had,
man,
fun last night, man.
I bet.
You
what
know,
I was thinking
the sad thing was, you know, I'm doing the merchandise thing after the show, and,
yeah,
and somebody comes running in. She said, man, Frida fell down outside.
Oh,
I said,
no.
What? So I ran out there, you know, and luckily somebody had called the, you know, the professionals, and they had already arrived that quick.
Oh, my
gosh,
she okay?
She was all right. You know, she did. There was no big mess, no, not a lot of blood, just scrape on her knee and,
oh,
something,
Jesus,
on her cheek.
Oh,
but
man.
She, yeah, yeah. But
I'm sure she's sore, too.
She's probably sore today. I texted her right before I called, right before you called.
Mm.
I wanted to make sure she was okay.
Yeah,
but I made her laugh, so I guess she wasn't too messed up.
Yeah, that's good. But I mean, hey, you know, we're not spring chickens anymore, any of us. So you know,
no,
a little bump does a lot. So you know,
yeah,
but,
you got
well.
That. Hey, listen, I had one of those about 2 months ago. A couple of guys from out of town came out to see me, and we went over to the farmer's market, had a couple of tuna fish sandwiches, and I'm walking to the parking lot, and it was the first day I'd put on my. My summer uniform is shorts and flip-flops.
Me too.
So I tripped over this little tiny curb, and I went smack on my forehead, man. Blood all over the place, and it took me to the ER 4 hours later and 4 stitches.
Yeah, we got to watch
getting
what we're
doing.
Getting
old ain't for sissies, my friend.
No, it is not. No, it is not. Oh, my God. Well, sir, I call you sir because you deserve that moniker. You are a musical genius and just an amazing career. And again, an honor to speak with you as a musician. It truly, truly is an honor to have you here on the show with me. And again, please come back anytime. I'd love it. And It's been great. I was thinking I may do a night and just play Larry's music as a little memory for him. So,
oh, I love it.
I may do that. So I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, please do that. That'd be great.
Yeah, because I wish I had met him in person. Unfortunately, we only knew each other on the phone and
everybody
messaging.
That met him loved him.
Loved him. Yeah,
he was one of those guys.
Yeah. Well, if you speak to Joey, send him my love too.
I sure will.
Joanne Barton at Applause Radio. Should I say, oh, that pain in the ass? Nah, he's a wonderful man. I try not to harass anybody.
No,
you know,
he's a good
guy. Anyway. But we've got to go. We've got a minute. I wish we could talk all night. But, oh, my God, thank you so much, everybody. Billy Vera from Billy Vera and the Beaters. Go. He's got a website, billyvera.com. He's got the three books. He's got the movie, everything, and his music. I mean, just forget about it. And you can get it everywhere, everywhere. It's online. And what is your website, billyvera.com? Is that it,
billyvera.com, yeah.
Got
it. Easy.
Oops. Sorry, we got interrupted. Yep. Well, thank you again. It has been a pleasure, and you have a wonderful evening. I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Well, thank you for having me, Joanne.
All right,
see you next time.
Thank you. Thank you, honey. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, my God. Billy Vera, everybody. Billy Vera. Oh, my goodness. What a thrill. I you know, it's so funny. He was on when the show first started, and I was thrilled then. But anyway, join us again. I've got 60 seconds. Join us again on Sunday, the 17th, with Tabitha Starcher. We're going to talk to her. She's the head of business development at the Emmy Awards, and she is going to be talking about the business of show. So that's going to be cool. 9 p.m. Sunday on the 17th. And have a good night. I hope you all had a good time. We'll close out with the at this moment. I don't know if I'll get the whole thing in, but take care. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
What did you think I would do at this moment when you're standing before me with tears in your eyes, trying to tell me that you found you another love. You just don't love me no more. What did you think I would say at this moment when I'm faced with the knowledge that you just don't love me? Did you think I would curse you or say things to hurt you? 'Cause you just don't love me no more. Come on, you know me too well. How could I hurt you when, darling, I love you, and you know I've never hurt you. Oh, what do you think I would give at this moment? Subtract 20 years from my life. I'd fall down on my knees, kiss the ground that you walk on. If I could just hold you again.